Tonight on Arena, Ruth Barton on how Thelma Louise changed or didn't change women in film, and Patrick McGrath on his new novel, Last Days in Cleaver Square. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Directed by Ridley Scott on a multi-million dollar budget with Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis in the lead roles, Thelma and Louise became one of the most talked about films of 1991. Many people thought that Hollywood would be changed forever, that we were entering a new era of gender equality on screen. 30 years on, what has changed and what has stayed the same for female-led blockbuster films? Joining me this evening to discuss just that is Ruth Barton to tell us more about where this iconic film sits in the history of feminist filmmaking. Just remind us, first of all, if you would, Ruth, the basic story behind Thelma and Louise, a well-intentioned weekend that becomes something totally different, a race across the states with the police in pursuit and a final confrontation at the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, on the face of it, a road movie. So in a road movie, our two protagonists go on a journey and find out something about themselves. But of course, the big difference is that normally it's two guys. The road movie is itself, you know, comes in the tradition of the Western, two guys on their horses going from east to west. And then it becomes, you know, two guys going on their motorbikes from east to west. And now, however, it's two women. And so, as you said, they start off that. We meet Thelma, who's played by Gina Davis, Louise, played by Susan Sarandon. They're packing up to go on a fishing weekend. Thelma is married to a total bore, a guy called Daryl, played by Christopher McDonald. And as soon as she gets on the road, she just wants to party. So they stop off in a roadside bar. It turns out she hasn't actually mentioned to him that she's going away for the weekend. But she doesn't care. She just wants to plug some drink into herself. And so at the bar, they, you know, they get down to some serious drinking, to some really serious line dancing, and she gets drunker and drunker, and a guy tries to take advantage of her. At that point, Louise pulls out a pistol and shoots him. And I'm not saying anything that people, like most people know the story anyway, and this all happens quite close to the beginning of the film. And for the rest of the film, they now have to go on the road because they're now criminals, and the police, led by Harvey Keitel, who's a very sympathetic cop.
Yeah.
Most of the guys don't come out so well in this story, but he does. And so he's leading the chase, and they have to flee to Mexico because that's where they believe they'll be safe.
And things get worse. Every mile they travel, things get worse.
Every turn in the journey, something happens to them.
The screenplay here, there were six Oscar nominations in total, and it won the best screenplay for Kelly Currie. How important was it that we had a female screenwriter here?
I think it's very important, though I do think we have to give Ridley Scott some credit as well, because Scott has a surprisingly good track record in terms of putting women, you know, in central roles. And so, you know, he made Alien, for instance, with Sigourney Weaver, another really iconic film that's mainstream Hollywood action film that has a very strong central female role. So we need to give him some credit, but this was her project, and you know, it took her a long time to get it off the ground. You know, who's gonna make a movie with two central female leads going on the road when one of them has shot a guy? And so it took a long time. It didn't even start with Gina Davis and Susan Sarandon in the lead roles. It really, really took a long time to get it up and running. But then, as you say, big budget movie, big budget treatment. And when it comes out, it just changes the way people think about women in film.
Yeah, how significant is it in those terms, in terms of feminist filmmaking? What kind of boundaries was it breaking in 1991?
I think it was huge. I remember the impact of it, and I was just starting to teach film at the time, and it just went straight onto the curriculum because of the fact that you have women literally in the driving seat, and they're fantastic, and they're glamorous, and they're feisty, and they can get their own back on the guys who impede them. But there were dissenting voices even then, and there have been dissenting voices since, saying, well, actually just reversing roles, putting women into men's roles doesn't achieve anything, because it just points out the fact that they're out of place, you know. And you want actually movies which have credible female roles in them rather than sort of fantasy female roles in them.
Just one thing that you mentioned there was that Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis were not the first choices, yet obviously, because we've seen the film with the two of them in it, it's very difficult to imagine for me, at any rate, the two characters being played by anybody else. Who were the first choices and how were they so long coming to both of them? They were reasonably well established, both of them at that stage, weren't they?
Those two, yeah, they were reasonably well established and have, you know, certainly I would have said Susan Sarandon has had, you know, a decent career since. But no, they weren't the first choices for those roles. The first choices, I've just introduced it. I've totally forgotten who I said the first choices were. But the first
Jodie Foster.
Jodie Foster. Thanks. Yeah. So they had to drop out. Jodie Foster, of course, made Silence of the Lambs around that time too. So she got. She got her big part, but it took so long that she couldn't actually, she couldn't stick with it at that time.
Yeah, and it was just a scheduling difficulty more than anything else that caused.
No, they really wanted to do it, but I have to say, Gina Davis was the one who really, really pursued it, and she was the one who got it.
Let's talk then about you. That was one aspect of the difficulty you mentioned, this idea that just putting women into men's roles was problematic for some people. Other people, I presume men, gave out about how the men were portrayed here.
There's always a bit of kind of male whinging around this film, but yeah, men have had it good, right? And they really get socked in the face in this one. In particular, Christopher McDonald, who was Gina Davis's ex-boyfriend, right? She gets this role as this just total klutz. He cannot say one thing right. There's actually a really funny sequence in it where Harvey Keitel is interviewing him. Harvey Keitel starts to laugh at something, which I suspect may have been an accident at the time. And he says, what are you laughing at? He said, well, actually, you're standing in your pizza. how to really diminish an idiot. But that's it. So they are. I mean, they're one-dimensional, the men. They are caricatures, apart from the Harvey Keitel. And also, yeah. I guess, kind of Susan Sarandon's, Louise's husband.
Yes, yeah, he's reasonably sympathetic as well. Let's listen to a clip that features Gina Davis as Thelma calling her husband Daryl, the ex-boyfriend, Christopher McDonald, and she's assuring him that they'll be home in a few days' time.
We're just going to stay there and, you know, fish and hang out and stuff, and we'll just be gone one more day, and then we'll be home tomorrow night.
No, you won't. You'll be back today. Now, you get your butt back here, Thelma, now. God damn it!
Daryl, you're my husband, not my father.
Oh, now, that does it. That Louise is nothing but a bad influence. If you're not back here by tonight, Thelma, well then, I just don't want to say.
Daryl?
Thelma?
Go fuck yourself.
Yes, rather rude language there from
Thelma, it must be said. Don't tell the children.
Yeah, he kind of deserves it, though, it has to be said. He's totally ineffectual, not Christian McDonald, the character of Daryl.
Daryl. I mean, he's the one that's most laughed at in the film, but, you know, it's a bit of fun. And also the truck driver who comes in, I don't think he's even credited. The truck driver who, he appears in three scenes. He overtakes them. He does kind of rude signs at them. And they really hold back, because by this stage they're letting rip in every other direction. They hold back until the third time he does it, and then they take their revenge on him.
What about Mr. Brad Pitt?
And
what we might call the female gaze here, I guess.
This is also coming on, you know, a foot of a lot of sort of feminist theorization of the way the woman is portrayed on the screen, with this idea that she's always there to be desired, right? And she doesn't have any identity. And this just absolutely switches it round. Brad Pitt was very, very young at this time. This film is 30 years old. And he was gorgeous looking. And he's portrayed, you know, he's portrayed as a male model. He has very little to do other than, I mean, he does advance the story slightly. But he's really there. for Thelma, Gina Davis, just to look at and adore, and, you know, to have very rewarding sex with, even though he robs their money. But he's in this kind of cowboy suit, and there's a real Western vibe to the whole film. He's in this cowboy suit. There's one fantastic sequence where he's just walking away from the car, and the film basically just focuses on his hips, and then Thelma looking at him, and she just, you know, can't get enough of what she sees.
Let's listen to the moment when Brad Pitt as JD makes his entrance and tries to sweet talk his way into hitching a lift.
Excuse me, ma'am. I ask which direction you're heading? See, I'm trying to get back to school. My ride fell through, and well, I'm kind of stuck here like stink on stink. So I was thinking that you're going my way, or I was going your way.
I think we're going to Oklahoma City, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, I'd appreciate it much.
Well, see, it's really not up to me. It's not my car. We'd have to ask my friend. But she'd probably say no. She's a little bit uptight.
Maybe it's not such a good idea. But I tell you what, I thank you for your time.
But, you know, I mean, I can ask. You know, it wouldn't hurt.
Well, no, it wouldn't hurt.
Hey, Louise. This young man here is on his way back to school. And I thought since we're going the same direction, you know, we could give him a ride, huh?
Probably not a good idea.
Please. No, probably not. But I appreciate your time. Y'all have a good day, all right? Drive safe.
Brad Pitt as JD and Thelma, played by Gina Davis, Louise, played by Susan Sarandon, in a clip there from Thelma and Louise, 30 years old. Yes, Ruth, go ahead.
And just not any old car as well. I mean, one of the iconic things is the Thunderbird that they're travelling in, and it's in every image, and it is the most beautiful car.
You have spoken a little bit about, you know, some feminists had a problem with the, you know, just putting men as effectively transporting the two women into two male roles, and then there was the whinging from men about the treatment of men. Is there a feminist reading of this film that really stands up and tells us why it has such iconic status?
I think it is just the fact that it came out of almost nowhere, and at a period where you know, now we have Promising Young Women, we have Me Too. We didn't have any of that. And I think the other thing was we're just moving from from one wave of very sort of feminism that said, you know, you couldn't have fun and you couldn't be beautiful, or maybe didn't quite say that, but people read it as that being a feminist was not fun. And we're just moving into a period where people are beginning to say, yes, you know, you can be a feminist, you can look great, you can have fun. And I think it just arrived at the cusp of that particular moment, which we now kind of take for granted. And I think that was its timing, was it just kind of came bombing in then and took everybody, you know, really took everybody by surprise.
There are loads of classic film references in this. Hitchcock is referenced, John Ford is referenced, and you can't ignore the locations, really, and particularly the location where it ends up.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so you've got the crop dusting sequence, which everybody recognises from North by Northwest, so that's your Hitchcock reference. But you're right in saying it's the setting, because it for the last about one third of the film, they're driving through Monument Valley, and you know, every John Ford film that you know, every Western is set in Monument Valley. So again, you've got two women in the cowboy roles, basically, going through Monument Valley. And there's a really great sequence where it slightly slows down a bit and they play the Ballad of Lucy Jordan, the Marianne Faithfull song. And they're just riding through Monument Valley, and you've got this, you know, this song that's all about women, you know, who've been hard done by. And it's really is a kind of celebration of women in that space. And then, of course, the ending is really Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid again with that kind of role reversal.
Yeah, I'll come back to the ending in just a second, but I wanted to just speak a little bit more about the soundtrack, because that Ballad of Lucy Jordan is hugely important, I think, in terms of the soundtrack. What about the rest of the basic country and western feel that's in there?
Yeah, it's got a real country and western feel. I mean, I was kind of thinking it must be Rykooda, but it isn't actually Rykooda, but it's got that Rykooda feel that, you know, you again might go back to something like Paris, Texas,
yeah,
to get that kind of country vibe that's coming the whole way through it. And it really sets it up because, you know, like a lot of soundtracks, you know, it's quite often in the background, but then it just comes, you know, ricocheting into the foreground. And so you have it being part of the story, like when they're doing the line dancing, which is kind of like quaintly dated now. but part of, you know, they're really enjoying it. It's a great thing. And it keep, you know, it comes in, it just kind of twangs in and into the background. And there's some great numbers. You've got Johnny Cash. You've got some really iconic performers on that soundtrack as well. It's on Spotify. I was listening to it over the weekend.
Yeah, it's a great version of that song as well. If you haven't seen the end of Thelma and Louise, turn the kettle on now or whistle loudly to yourself because we're going to discuss
it. Or just to get in your car and go on
yes,
the road.
Yes, stop listening. But come back in about 40 seconds time. The ending, where do you stand on it? Is it the great Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid? Is it the great ending for you or is it problematic for you?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, they drive off. Let's say they drive off the cliff and then it freeze frames as they go to their inevitable doom. Before doing so, they kiss each other too, and that's really given fuel to a kind of lesbian reading of the film that I think is really valid. I think it's fantastic because it just says it's a fantasy and this couldn't happen, and I think it's okay to say it couldn't happen. But for some, again, critics of the film, it says the fact that it couldn't happen is a problem. So the fact that there's essentially no physical space for them on the screen underlines the fact that this film could never have happened. But I think that the fact that fantasy element of it and that kind of bonding forever is absolutely consistent with the kind of the deep friendship that they've built up.
Does Thelma and Louise, the film, does it still hold up 30 years later for you, Ruth Barton?
Yeah, it did, you know, because the pacing is great and that relationship and those two actors are in their prime at that. So I think it's fantastic.
Well, let's finish with that final moment from Thelma and Louise. Thanks to Ruth Barton for bringing us through the movie on its 30th anniversary. They're driving towards Grand Canyon. The police have caught up on them. Nowhere left to go.
OK, then, listen. Let's not get caught. What are you talking about? Let's keep going. What do you mean? Go! You sure? Yeah. Hit it.
Closing moments there of Thelma and Louise, the Ridley Scott film, which is 30 years old this year. Ruth Barton speaking to us about it this evening. Patrick McGrath is the author of 9 novels, including the international bestseller Asylum. He's also given us 2 collections of short stories. His new novel, Last Days in Cleaver Square, is set in London in 1975. Francis McNulty is a celebrated ageing poet and a veteran of the Spanish Civil War. He's plagued by visions of General Franco, who appears on street corners, in the garden, and even at the end of Francis's bed. Meanwhile, the real Franco is dying in a palace in Madrid. Poetry, secrets, betrayal, lost love, and the Spartan business of growing old, this cleaving to life, as our narrator puts it, are all present in Last Days in Cleaver Square. And its author, Patrick McGrath, joins me now. Great to have you with us this evening. Patrick, what drew you to the Spanish Civil War for this particular tale?
There were various reasons. One was that for the last 30 years or so, I've been coming to Spain every summer. And I wanted to read more of its history. So I thought in a sort of writerly pragmatic way that if I read with the view to a story, my understanding of the recent history of Spain would be much improved. And so the Civil War immediately struck me as one of those very, very crucial historical events, in that it was a sort of the prelude to World War II, and it saw the struggle between democracy and fascism. And I was doing this work just at the beginning of the presidency of Donald Trump, when we were all very alert to the authoritarian tendencies of our new president. And so I read a biography by Paul Preston of of General Franco, and began to see the similarities between his personality and Donald Trump's. And then it occurred to me that if I set the novel in 1975, I could narrate it through an old man who had been in Spain in the late 30s, yeah. who had come out as part of the international group that of Americans and Brits and Irish and Europeans from who had seen that this was yeah. the first real struggle against fascism and that they had to join in.
How direct were the parallels that you saw between Franco and Donald Trump, seeing as that was one of the starting points for you?
There was a sort of grandiosity of the personality. There was an enormous vanity. There was tremendous need to dominate, to receive praise. There was a profound sense of paranoia. They were very quick, both men, to identify their enemies. And were restless and ruthless in the pursuit of their enemies. And I thought, these are probably the characteristics of most despots. But certainly those two shared those sorts of characteristics.
They also, I suppose, did it interest you the fact that there was a popular groundswell supporting both men?
Well, yes. That is the that is the puzzling aspect of it, that there should be the appeal that these strong leaders have, that they can provide a sense of certainty and security to large parts of the population, who seem to be able to entertain the idea that they may lose some freedoms, that their civil rights may well be infringed. But to have at a time of instability, a strong man in control seemed to have appeal in both situations.
The other aspect of the Civil War that I think is quite interesting here, you mentioned that, you know, that the people from various parts of Europe who were very involved, who went to Spain to fight on the side against fascism. There's still a kind of a romanticism around that, and particularly around writers, Orwell and Hemingway. Lorca obviously springs to mind as well in this particular case. How romantic a young poet was your narrator here, Francis McNulty, when he headed off to Spain?
I didn't go too deeply into what had motivated him. I think he was a poet, and he was of his period. At some point, he mentions meeting Auden, and I think he was swept up, as many artists were, by the idea that that freedom, that a republican government, that a democracy was threatened. And I think they were romantic to an extent, but they were also prepared to put their lives on the line. They went to Spain, they drove ambulances, they fought, they died.
Yes, and indeed, these are all part of aspects of the story that we hear in Last Days in Cleaver Square. The other aspect of this is, in the house in Cleaver Square, if we talk about Francis McNulty and his 1975 existence in Cleaver Square, with him there is his housekeeper, Dolores Lopez. And this has a hark back to the Spanish Civil War as well.
Yes. When Francis is in Madrid in the early years, or the beginning of the war, and Madrid is bombed by German aircraft, and he is close to a building in which a faint cry can be heard. And there is an American doctor there also. And the pair of them go into this building, and from beneath a fallen beam and from beneath the body of a woman who has been crushed by this falling beam, there is a small girl who has survived the collapse of this building. And she is rescued by these two. And in the fullness of time, Frances is able to get her to the coast and put on a boat to London, where his sister meets the child and takes her in. Mm. And this little Spanish girl grows up in Cleaver Square and becomes a member of Frances's household. And at the time of the novel, she is still there.
I wanted specifically to get a little bit of a handle on Dolores and why she is in the household, because I mentioned in my introduction that Frances McNulty, our narrator, this aging poet living in Cleaver Square, part of the Spanish Civil War, has visions or says he can see Franco in different places, on the street, in the garden, at the bottom of his bed. The other person who says she can see those visions as well is Dolores, his housekeeper. However, Francis's daughter, Jilly, is having none of this. How important was it for you to leave that ambiguity there, that in fact there was a possibility that it's not just that Francis is beginning to perhaps go insane, but that there is a possibility, if two people can see something and one person doesn't, well, that gives it some credibility.
Yes. Well, Dolores Lopez, I think we can assume that she has learned to speak English in her time in London, but she says almost nothing through the course of the novel. She is a presence rather than a voice. And I think Frances believes that she sees what he sees, and what he sees is it is an apparition. I think his daughter Jilly is very clear about this, and he too calls this vision of Franco that he sees in his garden an apparition, and yet he is sure that this is actually there. This figure is there. And I think we might say, well, he's in his late 70s. This could well be a function of sort of an ongoing nightmare, or the sort of the recrudescence of bad memories that are.
Yeah, because that is an important aspect of the book that I wanted to ask you about as well, which is this idea, I suppose, and there was almost an unwritten pact of forgetting agreed among many in Spain about the atrocities of the Spanish Civil War. Now, Francis has quite conveniently forgotten an aspect of his past in the Civil War as well, and an event that happened there that we don't need to go into. Suffice to say, he has kept it secret in the meantime. Was that an important driving force in the themes you wanted to discover, this idea that some things just have to be forgotten or buried in some way?
Well, I did address this, in the early pages, where he, in response to this hallucination, says, well, you know, they all want to forget it now, but how can we forget it, what we saw there? And the irony is that there is a very significant part of his own experience in Spain that he very much wishes to forget, because I think in the end, if you are involved, if you are present, you know, in war, not all your behaviour will be heroic. And Francis certainly has regrets and even shame for some of his actions. So the whole question of memory, and it was clear that, you know, as you mentioned, the pacto olvido, the pact of forgetting, was seen to be a way for Spain to get through the trauma of being divided, brother against a brother, and Francis is responding to this sort of, you know, this demand that we forget, because he wants to remember, and at the same time, he doesn't want to remember.
And that is the debate that goes on throughout the book. Patrick McGrath, thanks for speaking with us this evening, Patrick. And Patrick is speaking to us about his latest novel, Last Days in Cleaver Square. It's published by Hutchinson, and Patrick appears at Listowel Writers' Week on Saturday, the 5th of June. He'll be there at 5 p.m. The festival runs from the 2nd through until the 6th of June, and you can find out full details on Writers' Week. The The West Wicklow Festival kicked off last weekend, continues over the next 2 weeks through until June the 14th, features an array of talent, including the acclaimed Dutch violinist Roseanne Philippens and from France the pianist Julien Quentin. There's a strong Irish lineup as well, from rising Irish violinist Phoebe White, pianist Peter Regan and celebrated mezzo-soprano Rachel Kelly, all of which has been brought together by the festival's founder and artistic director, pianist Fiacra Garvey. Delighted to be joined now by Fiacra and Rachel Kelly, both of whom are on the line from London. Fiacra, this is the fifth year of the festival. Obviously a year, as we've heard so often in the last 12 months, a year like no other. Has it been difficult to put things together for you? I presume you were still working on the basis this is totally online and you can't do it any other way, because we had had no announcement at the point. You'd have had to be making your arrangements.
Yeah, hi Sean, thanks for having me on. So I suppose the festival is about a year now in the kind of making, in terms of from the first day of organising until where we are now. And yeah, we kind of realised even a year ago, we just thought it was probably going to be very unlikely that we'd be able to have audiences. And even if we could, we knew they'd be socially distant. And with the size of our home venue at Rusper House, which is a beautiful venue that we love dearly, but the room isn't huge, so we would only be able to have probably about 10 or 15 people in there if we did have a socially distanced audience. So it kind of just didn't make sense, really. But I have to say, despite, of course, look, we all want to have audiences back and we all miss audiences, but I've really, really enjoyed the challenge of putting the programme together. You know, it's been just really interesting dealing with sound engineers and videographers in different countries and different languages, finding alternative venues. But most importantly, from my perspective, I suppose, with the artists, being able to, you know, honour our contracts with them, continue to employ them, continue to employ, you know, everyone who's involved in marketing, to, you know, transport, to piano hire, to tuners. So I'm just really proud of the, I suppose, overall, not just artists, but the arts practitioners that we're kind of supporting from the festival. So it's been a challenge, but it's been really, really enjoyable, and we're reaping the rewards of that now with our concerts online.
I guess too, the other aspect of this is, Fiacra, that, you know, when you're talking about a festival where people have to be physically present in the venue for whatever weekend or week or over a period of time, they have to be available on that date. You have to be able to do all of that. Is there an aspect in terms of these, as we've been getting into with so many festivals, you know, recorded concerts, but that you can actually, people are more available to you now, and people, and perhaps artists are available to you now who may not have been able to travel to Ireland anyway because of other commitments or because of, you know, difficulties just in their diary. Is there a positive side to this as well?
Absolutely, Sean. And look, I think you always have to look at the positives, because you're not going to get anywhere looking at the negatives. But I think, like with our festival specifically, you know, we had, let's say, contracted these artists, so beyond the obvious travel restrictions, they would have committed to coming. But you're absolutely right. Like, for example, actually, Julien, who played with Roseanne, actually, he originally wasn't supposed to be part of the festival. He was supposed to be Zoltan Fejivari, and he couldn't make it. He couldn't obviously travel to Berlin to be with Roseanne. So she works a lot with Julien, and he was able to step in. So you're right. That's an example of, they're both in the same city, they couldn't get to Ireland, so isn't it wonderful that we could have someone else to work with Roseanne to deliver the concert? So there's definitely positives like that. In terms of the audience reach, like you've said, okay, usually we were limited on numbers physically in Rusborough and in St Mary's Church, but now you're right. I mean, the great thing about online is the reach is so much more. People can watch it whenever they like. Like, for example, our concert's happening. We've got one tonight with wonderful Phoebe White and Peter Regan. But people, if they can't watch it at 8 o'clock, they can catch up on it later on tonight or tomorrow or the next few days. And you're right. There's definitely positive aspects with that in terms of just people being able to do or enjoy the concert on their own time, in the comfort of their own home. And most importantly, from our perspective, we've really invested hugely in making sure that the recordings are tip-top quality in terms of sound and video. So it's not, you know, long gone, I suppose, are the days of, you know, someone just kind of getting a camera and setting up in one position and, you know, recording a concert. Like, we've really gone for multi-camera angles and really tip-top delivery. So it's as close to the concert experience as you can get at home.
And I guess that it will probably, some kind of hybrid might well be what we'll be seeing in the months and years to come, where you'll be both be able to attend a concert live and see subsequently a screening of it or a version of it. Let me go to Rachel, though, at this point, mezzo-soprano Rachel Kelly. When it comes to a concert like this, and maybe during... Hi, Rachel. Good to have you with us this evening. When it came to choosing...
Oh, thank you for having me.
Not at all. When it came to choosing your repertoire for a concert like this, and given what people have been through for the last 12 months, did that affect the type of choices you made and what you might perform?
Mm. Absolutely it did, Sean. I mean, for me, you know, it was such a sad year. I was meant to have, you know, so many really lovely debuts. I was in Denmark when you struck of coronavirus and everything shutting down. I was doing a title role in The Handmaid's Tale with the Royal Danish Opera. And so I just came home and basically had such a quiet year aside from going to Madrid. And so when the opportunity to have this concert with Fiacre came along and we were thinking about repertoire, I genuinely approached it a position of, I just want to sing. First of all, I just want to sing things that move me or make me happy and that will move and uplift other people. That was a huge factor because I think in the past, you know, especially in classical music, sometimes you choose repertoire, I'm ashamed to say, that, you know, is seen to be, you know, highbrow or you think you should be doing. And that wasn't the case with it. There are some, you know, lovely pieces by Debussy and all that. But yeah, no, genuinely, I just wanted to sing things that moved me and that would hopefully uplift the audience.
So were you a big fan of West Side Story then? Because there's one piece that jumps off the list that you have as part of your concert this year, which is Somewhere from West Side Story.
Yeah. Oh, West Side Story is one of the best. I mean, it's classified musical theatre, but one of the best music dramas that's ever been written. I think Bernstein was a genius. And I actually began singing musical theatre, so it's very, very close to my heart. I think in another life, I probably was a music theatre singer. So yeah, I absolutely love singing music from West Side Story and Rodgers and Hammerstein as well.
All right, well, let's have a listen to Somewhere from West Side Story. Mezzo-soprano Rachel Kelly there and pianist Fiacre Garvey in that performance of Somewhere from Bernstein's West Side Story. And that is one of the pieces that Rachel and Fiacre will be performing as part of this year's West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival. In fact, Fiacre, was that actually recorded in Rusborough House, that version that we just heard there now?
Yeah, so that was recorded in the beautiful music room at Rusborough. For anyone who hasn't visited, there's two beautiful pianos there, and that piano I was playing is the original Bluthner. So it's a very old and beautiful piano. You can probably hear that in the sound, but it's a piano that I think works so well for particularly the songs that myself and Rachel performed. It's really just what so many of those songs were composed with in mind, you know, a small saloon-type environment where you just would have friends around, you know, sitting on couches and chairs and listening to music in a relatively small space rather than, you know, the big concert halls of today. So that was the opening concert actually in the festival, which is still available. People can watch it online if they go to westwicklowfestival.com. And we've delivered, we're almost halfway through the festival now. Tonight is the fourth concert out of eight. And we will have four more coming after that. So immediately after the show, people can tune in to our Young Rising Stars concert. So that will mark 50% way through with four more to go.
Rachel, just to come back to you on something that you said, you mentioned about recording or you were working on an opera version of The Handmaid's Tale. Is this The Handmaid's Tale, the television series, the Margaret Atwood novel that we all know and I'm going to say love, but certainly have been watching?
Yes, it is. Yeah, that's
explain.
Right, yeah.
Tell me more about the opera version.
Yeah, so it's written by Paul Rudders, and it's I'm now going to do it in 2022 with Royal Danish Opera, and it's The Handmaid's Tale, so told by Alfred or of Fred, because she's under the guardianship or the commander Fred. That was the part, and obviously it's a contemporary opera, so it took a tremendous amount of work to get it off book because it's quite discordant and all that. very dramatic. It's fantastic. Fantastic opera. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, sounds extraordinary indeed. You're based in London now. How different are things a little bit ahead of us now in terms of, obviously things are beginning to open up for us now in the next couple of months.
Yeah.
What situation are you in London at the moment?
Well, I was vaccinated only yesterday and my husband was as well. So they're really getting down to the low 30s now in the UK. And I think it's opening up for the late 20s, maybe next week. And I think opera houses are reopening. Myself and Fiacra, we have a recital at Whitmore Hall on June 20th to an audience. I think they're going to be socially distanced, but I think they're slightly ahead of us here. Everything is opening up. Restaurants are open with social distance. So it's quite hopeful here, I have to say. Hopeful for the future. Hopefully we can avoid a third lockdown, I hope.
I think we all want to avoid that. And Fiacra, Richard, speaking there about an upcoming performance at the Wigmore Hall in June with a live audience. Will that be your first time back in front of a live audience since the beginning of all of this?
No, so I've actually been pretty lucky. I've managed the UK, so back in October, actually, they briefly opened up concerts again to audiences, and I did a few concerts in October and November, and then everything got shut down again. But yeah, it'll be the first time with audience since November, actually. So still a pretty long period of time, but we're just so excited to... unfortunately, it's not going to be broadcast, that concert from Wigmore, but any of our... close friends and people, at least in London, can come along and at least have people to sing to and play to, which will be brilliant.
The other thing, Richard, you were speaking there about working with Danish National Opera. Obviously, as an Irish citizen, you have an EU passport. That makes things difficult for you. I believe that some of your colleagues, whoever, who don't have the European passport, are finding it more difficult.
Tremendously difficult. Yeah, I have a very close friend who has an amazing career that's sort of just beginning, and he's going to the Metropolitan in a year and Paris Opera. And he was due, I mean, after a terrible year of COVID, to have one of the best financial years yet, which he was really excited for. But however, he's just encountered some new rule that he can't work more than a certain number of days in any consecutively in Europe or something. And he said to me he'll be lucky if he even sees a third of the contract that he was originally booked for, which is completely debilitating after a year of no earnings to then have, you know, promised earnings completely slashed. And it's terrible. He has no Irish granny or anything. He can't apply for a European passport. He definitely did not vote for Brexit. And he just feels pretty, sorry for the word, but shafted by his government.
There
you know.
You go. Well, listen, we'll finish up with a little bit of the Debussy Se Lek Stadze, which you're going to perform as part of the concert in West Wicklow as well. Just lead me into this, if you would, Rachel. That's tell great. Me a little bit about the song.
Yeah, so this is Se Lek Stadze by Debussy, and it's just a song about sheer ecstasy, and it's one of my favourites, so I always love singing it. I hope, hopefully that translates.
Just a little flavour of Debussy and Se Lek Stadze, Rachel Kelly there, accompanied by Fiacra Garvey on piano. And Rachel and Fiacra will be closing the West Wicklow Festival with a concert on Monday, June the 14th, featuring music from Debussy that you just heard there, Leonard Bernstein you heard earlier, Rossini, Rodgers and Hammerstein, and many more. 8 p.m. tonight, you can hear the violinist Phoebe White and pianist Peter Regan in a programme that includes Beethoven, Bartok and others. All of the concerts streamed on Monday and Thursday evenings until June the 14th. They can be viewed on westwicklowfestival.com. Free to view, but donations most welcome. That is our lot for this Monday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 1st of June at 7 p.m. here on RTE Radio 1.